Yeah, I guess, is there anything else you guys want to talk about here? Anything at all? We could, I mean, we could.
We could talk more about Boy Meets World, and I could find out what it is.
We could do
I'm so down for that.
Oh, I really wish that Boy Meets World, like, happened, like, presently, and then I could do a podcast.
But, like,
a
Girl Meets World, though.
It's not that good.
I haven't watched it.
Yeah, I like we're on our third track now.
Nice.
Which is the, do you have the last page of the story? Because I know that's where I had some of my questions. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I got it.
All right, so...
Are we recording now?
Yeah, this is on.
Carefully excavated and reassembled from an ancient burial site in Egypt, after a week in limbo, back from the dead.
Coming to you from a studio within an Egyptian pyramid.
Hello and welcome to Glyphs, the podcast where we talk about glyphs and with the people who etch them. I'm Phil.
I'm Jack.
And this is The Beans. You're listening to the 9th episode of Words. It's Easter Sunday, April 5th. With only a couple of weeks left, we're getting close to the end, so we're going back. Way back
in time.
In this episode, we kept finding the influence of ancient cultures, Coptic, Egyptian, and religion on the writing we do today.
We should have an ancient Egyptian themed literary podcast called Glyphs.
Just the language is going to get eroded over time, I think. And that's, I think, why sort of Shakespeare just and Milton are kind of like... You know, I mean, I personally kind of still wish we said thou.
Feel free to hit pause, press the download button, and listen at your leisure. If you'd like to learn more about our contributors, go to our website at www.wordsthepodcast.com.
Nail it. Allie Wright is a fiction writer whose short story, As a Widow Throws a Lasso, is a meditation on grief and the grieving process. Allie grew up in a house full of books and always loved words. Now, she's just been accepted into the creative writing subconcentration at the University of Michigan. In this segment, we talked about making the familiar unfamiliar, an ancient jackal god of death called Wawet, animorphs, and finding inspiration in everyday places like Snapple
Friday.
Caps.
We're here in the studio with Allie Wright to talk to her about her short story, As a Widow Throws a Lasso, or Lasso. And this is a story about a woman named Edith. And could you maybe give us like a brief synopsis, maybe just what Jack likes to call it, a roadmap of what can we expect from this story? What's the higher concept?
Well, I guess it's like mostly a story about grief and kind of the way that, people cope with their grief.
Okay.
And it's kind of like a weird sort of magical realism kind of look at grief and an exploration of like this one woman and her kind of process after she loses her husband. Like, they're both, like, they're old, and mm-hmm. she loses her husband, and it's like she kind of has lost her way, and then it just kind of goes from there into, like, this weird kind of surreal place.
Yeah, at the very end, we get to a place where, I mean, when you say magical realism, it becomes outside of the realm of possibility and a little bit more fantastic or fabulous or however you want to talk about it. So that's an interesting switch. We start off with a really very simple, very factual sentence, and we end up in a very different place, so I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I really loved the ending. And obviously, you kind of dropped the hints throughout that she is having a lot of difficulty coping with this grief. And so, like, when the ending happens, it's not jarring because you kind of have, like, all these these little, like, road signs on the way. It really makes you care for Edith a lot, too, because you kind of go through this whole thing with her. Do you remember exactly how you got the idea?
I was reading, actually, As I Lay Dying, and concurrently with that, I was reading a lot of, like, Gertrude Stein. And she has this poem, and it's called As a Wife Has a Cow, a Love Story. And it's, like, this prose poem, but it's, like, language poem. So it's not really about anything in particular. It's just about kind of the sounds of the words. And I actually read on like a Snapple cap or something that it's like, it's illegal to like lasso a fish in Tennessee. And I was like, that's weird. And I kind of liked the phrase like to lasso a fish or something. Like it was like, yeah. I kept like playing with this phrase in my mind. And then I read As I Lay Dying for like the millionth time. And there's that Vardaman chapter where he's like, my mother
my
is a fish.
Fish yeah.
And I was like, holy crap, like that's amazing.
What
so
if?
Yeah. So like I had that kind of that kind of moment where like Gertrude Stein and William Faulkner kind of like copulated in my brain and yeah. created this kind of weird
that,
concept.
That, that
for
image
me.
Is in my mind of them two copulating. Okay. Yeah, and just Vardaman shouting, my mother is a fish.
I I love that book. I love that chapter, and like just the fact that it's a one sentence chapter. Just Faulkner, man.
He wrote that book, I guess, like in 8 weeks, and he wrote it like at night, and I think in the mornings before work and after work, mm-hmm. and he didn't edit it at all, and like sent it to his editor or whatnot, and they just like published it basically as is, and they're like, oh, one of the greatest novels of the 20th century, mm-hmm. and it's like, what the hell, man?
That's the myth, anyway.
I guess, yeah, but even if that was like half the myth, it's not fair. It's not fair.
So one of the interesting ways that the story starts shifting towards that other place that we get to at the very end is, I think, in the house. And I think it's part of, one of the major physical movements in the story is that Edith leaves her house. She doesn't feel at home in her house anymore. And there's just all these little places. For example, on page 5, at the very top, it says, "It was unbearable, the emptiness of the house and the way it was changing without Edith's permission." And I think that we start getting evidence of that change and without her permission in smaller ways as we get through the story. So, for example, on page 6, the page after, the house was becoming something different entirely. Things were shifting shape, undulating, becoming things that they were not, which I thought was just, it's such a simple sentence. The language isn't reaching for any complex or vivid imagery, but it's just in the way that something is becoming that it isn't, and I really like that a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting how she just seems kind of like, lose control, where like this kind of fantastic elements of the story in which she, rafts down the river out to the Pacific Ocean. It's just kind of, I guess not Pacific, but Atlantic, I guess.
Whatever
either,
ocean.
Either or, yeah. But either way, yeah, these fantastic elements, not like she is spurring them on, but they're almost kind of imposing themselves mm-hmm. on her. And I guess, yeah, for listeners out there, so yeah, in the ending, I guess to totally spoil Allie's story, that she eventually drags out this bed, which has so much significance because it is the bed that her late husband, carves the headboard into, which is this beautiful headboard that has sunflowers, and he used to read and have his back up against it. And maybe, if we could find this little section, just read that real quick. Yeah, I'm not sure yet, Allie, if you just want to read that.
Noah had spent weeks crafting the headboard, selecting the proper wood, and designing the carvings. The headboard itself was simple and rectangular, with two short posts at each end. The real beauty was in the carvings Noah had done. Huge, intricate sunflowers decorated the headboard, each petal carved precisely. The leaves of the flowers sprawled out and touched the leaves of the flowers next to them, overlapping and connected. Noah used to read in bed, his back against the headboard, and when he would sit up, there would be sunflowers imprinted on his back. Edith would trace the shape of them on his skin, and Noah would kiss the tip of her nose. It was these things she would miss the most.
That's just so great. And so this is the bed that she then drags down. Well, it is the whole bed, right?
Mm-hmm,
that
she
drags down, tosses in the river, gets on top of, and she like wakes up to be in the middle of the sea.
That was the moment when I was reading this story when I got it. I was like, okay, it's a story about grief. And I'm there for that, and I'm like... And we reached that point, and it was like, oh, this story is going somewhere completely differently. it changes everything that preceded it, and like suddenly, Edith is the woman that sails her bed down the river. And mm-hmm. I thought, I was like, ah, that's amazing. So that for me was like where the story was hinged on or whatever. For me, like that was the main action. I really liked the way that once you read that, everything else in the story changes its significance. So that was really cool. And you mentioned magical realism, which I like a lot, as a genre, I'm not sure if you would call it a genre, but there's all these little, almost banal details that go into this story that ends up being such a not banal story. there's the Christian house visitors, the Pyrex, the interesting name of the, must have been like a Polish waltz band. So all these little details. And I guess I'm wondering, in the process of writing this story, there must have been certain images that stood out to you. There must have been something about the character and grieving, and you did mention some literary influences. But this seems like an amalgamate of a lot of different pieces. What were you drawing from your own experience, and how did this story come together, not just as a literary thing, but something from your experience?
Actually, I really thought about my grandparents in writing this story. I lost my grandfather 2 years ago to kidney cancer. And so, like, it's taken me a while to get to the process, like, through the process where I felt like I could, like, write about it or, like, kind of be be far enough away from the actual event to kind of like render it in my own words and my own imagination. Mm-hmm. And so like these characters are kind of like my grandfather and my grandmother and like those like really banal details. No joke, I go up north to Port Austin in the thumb of Michigan, and there's like a town, a couple towns over, that has a Polish festival every year with all these like, you know, crazy cool polka band names. And like my mom is 100% Polish, so like we have that's like a big part of my background, I guess.
That's cool. That's cool. I like that. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those people, you can see on my hand, listeners can't, but I have like little notes that I write down. I'm like constantly looking for things like that. What is on the bottom of those little glass containers that like my mom uses? Pyrex. There it is. So yeah, I really appreciated that attention to detail in this story, and it really brought out, like I said earlier, just the reality of those small details made the fantastic believable, and that was really powerful, I think. So,
and just little details like the little chip on the cup that that doesn't seem like it's in the right place of the cup, this old mug, and yeah, it's kind of like when you start to realize things aren't necessarily going right, that there might be something going on behind the scenes. I really like though earlier what you said about kind of Gertrude Stein, and it does kind of bring into this this discussion, this idea of the subconscious, and I think there's like so many different like themes of the subconscious kind of in this piece. And as you said, yourself, a lot of this is based off of, the words off of Snapple Cap.
Yeah.
And it's like these like weird mundane details that kind of like weave into our lives and yet are also in some ways extremely important in a weird way. Like some of these details seem so random, but yet seem to have such a weight to them too. Yeah, how do you come up with some of these smaller details? Do they just pop into your head?
I guess like I just think about things that I own or my parents own or that were in my grandparents' house, and my mom is like a fanatic for like collecting mugs, so we have like two entire cabinets in our house for like mugs, and like some of them are chipped and old, and she just will not throw them away because she loves them. And
does she drink like an amazing amount of coffee?
She does. She has gone through an entire box of like those like Keurig chai tea things in like a day.
What?
Which is horrible.
That's like, that might, she should see a doctor.
it's insane.
Wow.
It's impressive. It's very impressive.
Yeah, my dad, I swear that guy puts IVs into his arms of coffee. I don't want to get to that point.
Did you talk about prose poems earlier? Is that correct? Is that
yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I was noticing some more like some of the sonic qualities of this this story, and I really like, just for example, like the Wet River, like that is such a like a telling name. It says a lot about this the idea you're evoking without even describing it any further. So I like that.
Wet.
It seems, I mean, the word sounds like it's ebbing, So that I thought was cool. And there's just all little places like that, like the water was star speckled, swirling. So there's like little nods to the language that this story is being told in. So I guess my question is, and as a person who is frequently like...
Well, let me interrupt you real quick, Phil, because I actually...
Go for it, yeah.
Not to steal your thunder here, but I had a discussion with Allie beforehand about the Wet.
Oh, okay.
And it is a jackal god?
Yeah, it's an Egyptian jackal god called Wepwawet, and he's like a death god, and his like name translates to like the parter of the ways, or the opener of the ways, which I thought was interesting, and it was a good name for a river, so...
Awesome.
This is a little off topic. But how did we figure out that Wepwawet are like the sounds of that hieroglyph?
Well,
because there's the Rosetta Stone, right?
Yeah, it's weird because in my archaeology class we learned that like they don't actually know the true pronunciation of a lot of like Egyptian like glyphs, and they just insert kind of like unstressed E sounds.
Really?
So like, yeah. So because like they went back to like the Coptic languages and stuff and like figured some of them out, but like for the ones that they don't know, they just insert like an unstressed E. So
it could really be like anything.
It could.
I like I think it'd be really cool if like that god's name, for whatever reason, through like the randomness of the universe, if it was like Rocky Road Ice Cream. If that was just his name, like that's how you actually pronounce that hieroglyph. And they were just like, all worship jackal god Rocky Road Ice Cream. Which they probably didn't.
I don't think they had ice cream in ancient Egypt.
Well, but that was just his name, though. They didn't know. It was just like a random assortment of syllables.
I guess.
We can hope, at least. I like the scene. I like to, at least it's nice to think about anyway.
Yeah.
So that thunder went somewhere. Where did it go?
Wait a minute. Wait, we should have an ancient Egyptian themed literary podcast called Glyphs. No.
I dig it.
Sorry.
You can only write in hieroglyphs.
We're talking about a story, aren't we?
They're actually, yeah, I think so. Well, here's another question, I guess. So you're a writer, so you're writing all kinds of things, and you're in a writer state of mind occasionally, at least. So mm-hmm. what other things do you, what are you writing? What do you, I mean, this is one of a body of work. So what else are you working on?
Actually, I was just talking to Jack about this. Since April is poetry month, I've taken on like poem a day challenge, like write a little short poem every day, but I'm like really crap at poetry. But like, I like to work on things about kind of the surreal spaces of the mind. So I guess I just write a lot of stuff that's kind of like this. But like right now I'm working on a story about like a bunch of like 13-year-old girls and that kind of weird space of like early teenagerdom, especially for girls. It's just a very bizarre place to be. And I think that there are lots of really bizarre places to be in life that we don't necessarily like look at and think they're bizarre, but they really are. Mm. So that's kind of what I write about and what I'm working on all the time.
Cool. Very cool.
And when you write, so like this story, do you write mostly like in one sitting, or do you kind of come back to things? Or can you only write when it's like 3 o'clock at night?
No. Well, the funny thing was like that Snapple Cap thing happened in like July. And then I wrote this story in like, I don't even know, maybe October or September. So like, I guess I kind of find like a line or like I have a, like a sentence and then I'll think about it for months and months and months and I'll sit down and write like 5 or 6 pages and then go through like an expansion phase. So it doesn't all happen in one sitting. It's so like I'm a very slow worker.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. It has to percolate.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess this is more of a question of biography, but where does writing fit into your life? Are you a writer? Do you think of yourself as a writer? Is this like part of your major, or what do you, how does it fit in?
Well, I actually just got accepted to the subcon in creative writing. Nice. So I guess I'm kind of a writer, question mark.
Hey, if you write, period. You're a writer. That's the yeah, period.
Know.
Period.
So yeah, I guess that's kind of how it fits in. And I've always been like a person obsessed with like words and books, and I grew up in a house where there were books in every room, like including the bathroom, so like
perfect,
you know.
There should always be books in the bathroom.
Bathroom literature is a recurring theme of this podcast.
Yeah.
For a good reason. I think that it's an important space to be creative in.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I put my short stories in the bathrooms at our house, that's all my housemates get to read my stories.
That's lovely. I should do that to my housemates.
Yeah.
Just pace them to the walls.
Yeah, I don't know. I've got America the Book in my bathroom, which I've just always had in my bathroom, which is, you know, by Jon Stewart in The Daily Show.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just this incredible fake textbook about America. And it has just been in my bathroom for like the last 10 years. And I just always read it. And I find new things to laugh about every time I read it.
Truly.
Thank you. We're going to miss Jon Stewart. But.
Yeah, me too. I'm excited for Trevor Noah, though. I like discovered Trevor Noah recently. I mean, there's been this media blitz about him, so it's hard not to, you know, see him on your Facebook feed. But he seems like a pretty rad person, so yeah. I'm excited for new Daily Show stuff.
Yeah, changing times.
Oh, and this can be the part of the podcast where, like, Bob Dylan comes on softly in the background.
Wait, let me talk to our lawyers about that. Those copyright fees. Wait, Amber District Library, you guys have this one, right? All right, Matt's not here, but I'm assuming he's nodding his head.
I think that he would approve of this.
Yeah, they can waive
in
that
spirit,
fee for
in
us.
Spirit, I think, yeah, this aligns with Matt's values, as I know Matt. So
all right,
we're
well,
good. Okay. Let's just go right ahead. Okay, here's this. There's a quote that was, I was asking, I don't know if you know Peter Ho Davies, but he's this fiction writer in the English department here, and he's really a brilliant person. And I was like, I'm leaving soon. You should tell me some advice about writing. He was like, okay, we can do this. And one of the really interesting things that struck me about his advice was that he said, this Ernest Hemingway quote, and it was like he aspired his fiction to affect in the reader like recalling a memory. So he wanted to, if you think of like fiction writing and writing in general just being like the only art form that whose materials are wholly abstract, you're basically working with, you know, the reader's imagination. What can you evoke in this person's imagination? Hemingway was going for that feeling of like nostalgia. What are you remembering? Like, I want this story to feel like something that it's like a memory of a place that you've never been to almost. So is there any like cool way you have of thinking about like what you're trying to accomplish in your fiction, or do you have like a poetics, or is there Is there anything?
Is there an Ernest Hemingway quote?
Yeah, actually, that and more simply, like, yeah, do you have any guiding lights like that that you return to?
I'm a really big David Foster Wallace fan, so I read a book of interviews of him a while ago. And one of his things was he was really obsessed with making the familiar strange. Okay. And like, I'm really obsessed with that. And I guess I kind of want people, if/when they read the things that I write, I want them to be uncomfortable, I guess, a little bit. I want them to be like, oh, that's really weird. But I also don't want them to be alienated. I want it to be like uncomfortable, but kind of like, I don't know, like it, like to draw you in, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a cool way to look at that.
Yeah. Familiarity.
Yeah.
Familiarity. I'll just do it again. Okay. yeah. No, you've exhausted my questions. I don't know, Jack, if you've got anything that left on your mind, but,
yeah, I guess the concept of the story is just very interesting. It's not the type of story that I would write, you know, it's not, But how do you get the idea to kind of say, like, I'm going to have this? Because when I read this, I thought of it, you know, like there's like stories that are books and they describe them as a descent into madness. Mm-hmm. I kind of thought this was like an ascent into madness, because I like the ending a lot, and it's kind of an uplifting way. And I think it ends very nicely. So it's not a descent. It's kind of an ascent, mm-hmm. Where she kind of goes through this, magical realism / fantastic. You know, is it really happening? Is it not? Mm-hmm. Yeah, how did you know, like, I'm going to have this grandma that, you know, is having trouble coping with this death, and she's, you know, going to go on a little bit of a trip?
I don't really know. I don't really know how, I don't remember how that kind of came about in my brain. I guess, well, because I was so obsessed with that Faulkner story with As I Lay Dying, like, I thought about that part where Ma's coffin goes into the river, and there's this whole, like, just, you know, insane kind of, like, madness that happens there.
I just want to say, though, like, all the characters in that book are very dislikable.
Yeah.
But all the characters in this one are very, very likable.
Well, thanks.
Except, I don't know, some of the church ladies seem a little grating.
Yeah, yeah. That's some of my own experience with different churches and different people in churches. But, you know, we don't have to go there.
Happy Easter.
Happy
listeners.
Easter. Happy Good Friday, guys.
Yeah. Okay. So, like, the last point of ostensible reality, like the last point where it's actually like trying to be real, I think is where we get to this point where she says, or where the narrator's like, was it the Atlantic? Was she dreaming or dead? It didn't matter.
Yeah, where do you think actually, or do you even know where Edith is?
Because we get to the vast blue that sprawled out before, and we have no idea. That could be anything.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I just kind of imagine that maybe she like fell asleep out in the woods near the house. Mm-hmm. And, like, she possibly could have died.
Maybe she's hallucinating from dehydration.
Yeah.
This is her last moments, and she's dreaming about water.
Yeah, I just read Into the Wild about, so that's, is she in Alaska?
No, she's not in Alaska. She's in Wisconsin at this point. Okay. No, not when she's, going down the river, but she starts in Wisconsin, and then she ends up where? We don't know. I want you to, figure it out. It's all
Come
in
on,
your
reader.
Brain.
Yeah.
It's all in your brain.
You should have had, like, I think we've talked about this on the show, too, like, those, like, pick your ending books.
yeah, choose your adventure.
Yeah. There was an Animorphs one of that. It was really good. I need to reread that series.
Animorphs?
Animorphs was everything to me. Scholastic book fairs. Yeah.
What about like, Michigan Chillers, though? Like, American
That was
chillers.
After my time. That was Yeah.
That's great. Those are awesome.
I did read a few, but they weren't, and it wasn't an Animorphs level of appreciation.
Yeah. You know, I just want to say, they recently put Animorphs, the Nickelodeon TV series, on Netflix.
Did they?
Yeah, and so, like, me and my housemates were like, this is amazing, and we went to go watch episodes of them. That TV show is terrible. It is, like, it was unwatchable. And, like, I watch a lot of, you know, pretty unwatchable TV, but, like, that was like, really sad.
I'm sorry. It was such a disappointment for you.
Yeah. And, you know, Boy Meets World is still not on Netflix.
That's so dumb. Can I just talk about how much I relate to Topanga on, like, a spiritual level?
Really?
Yeah, I love her. She's great.
Wow. Yeah, that's like the greatest show to ever air on TV, I think.
It is. Like, I aspire to be Topanga, but I think I'm more of an Eric.
Really?
Yeah.
Plays with squirrels. That was my favorite episode, was the plays with, or the Halloween episode when everything like goes crazy and like then it gets like really deep at the end when it turns out Sean's the killer and he's also and it was a weird dream. And Phil, how much Boy Meets World have you watched?
I don't even know what it is.
Wait, oh my! There was a semester of college where all me and my buddy Levi did was sit on the couch, eat Reese's Puffs, watch Boy Meets World, and play Star Wars Battlefront on the PS2. I mean, like, that was possibly, like, a very low point in my life. But it was also really, like, a really high point. I don't know, like, that was...
Star Wars Battlefront is a high point.
Dude, right?
I love that.
I mean, but, like, you know, look at me now. I've got a general studies degree.
You've got a cardigan.
Yeah, dude.
I've got a cardigan, and I'm producing a podcast that pays me in love.
And yeah,
and now it's suddenly become relevant again, and and everything has come full circle.
It's all yeah,
perfect. Everything is perfect.
Noah died in early March when the branches of the old oaks were still bare and creaked in the wind. They took his body away from the farmhouse in an ambulance that drove slowly up the winding lane, urgency being unnecessary when there was nothing left to be done. Noah had refused to die in the hospital between sterile white walls, hooked up to machines, and being poked and prodded by nameless, faceless doctors and nurses. Dying in his family home was his only option, and when things got bad and the waiting began, hospice workers moved him from the home hospital bed in the parlor to his own bed, the bed he'd built for his wife Edith as a wedding gift 56 years ago. Edith slept on a cot near the bed where Noah slept in the last days of his life, beneath the afghan she'd knitted 2 winters ago, picking at the stitches and staring out through the window at the white coin face of the moon. Noah's ragged breathing kept her semi-conscious, incapable of full and blessed sleep. Their 4 children drove in from Madison, 4 hours south of their childhood home, with their children the Sunday before he died. Each took turns holding his hands, whispering to him, trying to love him well again. The house was shrinking around her, threatening to swallow her whole. 2 Sundays after Noah's passing, she dragged the heavy bed from the bedroom to the parlor and slept there that night. The house seemed to be breathing, rattling in the same way Noah's breath had rattled in his chest before he died. It was this rattling that made her drag the bed from the parlor, out the door, across the back field, and from the back field to the river. The dragging was hard and the bed was heavy, and by the time she reached the Wet'suwet, she was drenched in sweat and her back was screaming. She had scraped the walls with the bed and left scratches in the wood floor, but she no longer cared. It was no longer her home. The house wanted her out, and she obliged. She would sleep here now, in the open and the cold. She lay down beneath the bare branches and wrapped herself in the yellowing sheets, watching the river sweep along, swirls and eddies, deep black pockets of water, dead leaves, shards of ice like glass. The branches felt like hands nudging her toward the water, the willows like people closing in over her. The wind whispered through their branches and seemed to encourage her toward the water. She dragged the bed to the riverbank and pushed it in. Edith climbed on top of it, expecting to sink, hoping that maybe she would, but the bed, mattress, frame, headboard, and all, was miraculously and impossibly floating.
And her back was screaming. this not only was a personification of the house as like a body, but it was like a sick body. It was like an illness had happened. And I was reading about illness, and it was like one common thing that people who journal about what they're dealing with will write down is that they get this feeling of dissociation and they feel like their body has disowned them in a way. Mm-hmm. And so when I read that, I was like, this is like the same thing. It's like when you have to vomit because you can't have this thing be a part of you anymore because it's unhealthy or something. So mm-hmm. just that, that
like rejection by the host.
Yeah. Yeah. Like this, the pathology of this, I think even if that's a word that you can use. And just in many ways, the whole story is kind of like, waiting for this whole moment to happen. So that was great. I like that.
Thank you. Edith awoke at sunrise. It felt as if she had traveled a vast distance in the night while she slept. The Midwestern spring cold had vanished, and she now found herself at the mouth of the river where it opened to the sea. Was it the Atlantic? Was she dreaming or dead? It didn't matter. The vast blue sprawled out before her, and a warm sea breeze filled her nostrils with salt and heat. The sun gashed the night sky open, and Edith watched its twin in the water as it rose and glimmered. Edith shed the sheet she'd been wrapped in, peeled the clothes from her weary, feeble frame, and dipped her feet into the water, the coolness soothing her, bringing her comfort. Shadows swam beneath the surface. Edith peered over the edge of the bed and realized they were enormous fish, the size of small cars, curiously circling and gazing up at her with wide, glassy eyes. One of these fish, pale and translucent, swam near the surface and around the bed for what felt like hours. Edith was tired. Every bone in her body longed for relief. She was floating on the ocean, the impossible, huge, terrifying ocean. She was exhausted. She was alone. The sun hovered high and the fish swam around her, the waves gently rocking and lapping at the bed as the fish glided below. The pale fish gazed at her with its huge eyes, and Edith reached out to touch it as it swam by. It dove down, and she watched it loop below her in slow, graceful arcs, amazed that such an enormous creature could move so beautifully. Edith wanted to be with the fish, to swim with it in the cool water and watch the world through its watery eyes. Edith tried to catch a dorsal fin whenever one of these fish came close enough, but it was no use. They would spiral down a little deeper and continue their circuit out of reach. The thought of Noah came to Edith, of him at the county fair roping a calf and bringing home a blue ribbon. The grin on his face and the sweat on his brow were the first things Edith had fallen in love with. She was 16 and had watched him rope the cattle, swinging the lasso from horseback and letting it sail, watching it land gracefully around the animal's neck. She knew she loved him then, as he leapt down from the horse and tied the calf fast, sticking his arms in the air when he finished, triumphant and shining. The thought of Noah this way as she tore the sheets into strips and twisted them together, knotting them and braiding them as the sun arced over her and the moon came up again. The moonlight illuminated the fish swimming below her, rendering them almost iridescent. The palest fish was down low, swimming languidly and gazing up at Edith, tying the strips of cloth together. Her wrists and fingers ached from the effort and fatigue, but she continued tying and braiding, watching the fish circle below her, hugely graceful and gleaming. She tied the noose at the end and slid the knot the way Noah had shown her when she was young. The ocean was black now, and the moon's wavering reflection shone in Edith's eyes as she gazed downward, waiting for her fish. He swam up close to the surface, wide-eyed, and Edith tossed the lasso, hoping the knot was strong enough to hold. The great fish was snagged, and Edith tumbled over the edge of the bed into the water and home.
Thank you.
Drew Marin is a writer of short fiction, but we never really got to that part. We talked about making literature accessible as a mark of a good professor, free will, and what 50 Shades of Grey and Paradise Lost have in common is fan fiction.
So, have you ever read John Milton?
You mean like the old blind guy, right?
Yeah, exactly. The old blind guy.
That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean... Paradise Lost, because we were both in a class with Professor Linda Gregerson, amazing professor, if she listens to that. seriously, amazing professor, amazing poet, national book finalist. I always kind of measure sort of like how good a professor is, like if they can make someone like, if they can milk something, that was weird.
if they can milk Milton.
If they can milk.
And I'm just imagining your English professor milking an old blind man.
Okay, well, anyway. No, but that was a good, you guys got to a good point. So you're saying something about what is it that makes you realize a professor is really good at their job or something? It was something like that.
Oh, well, like two of my favorite professors, Professor Douglas Trevor, Professor Scotty Parrish, Professor Linda Gregerson. I think that there's this ability of, maybe we're also like sort of, I guess if you're like an English major, you're predisposed to sort of liking certain things, but like, Professor Trevor taught Shakespeare and Professor Gregerson is teaching Milton, and it's really unfortunate because the public conversation, you talk about Shakespeare, you talk about Milton, and it's like, oh, Shakespeare.
Right, yeah.
Milton. I never understood Milton. And of course, when it's funny, because like, whenever I talk to my my parents like about Milton, for example, my dad just can't help but quote Animal House.
Okay.
The scene where Donald Sutherland says, "Look, I find Milton just as boring as all of you."
Okay.
What part is that from?
The class. It's Donald Sutherland's class. And it's like everyone's asleep, and he's like, he doesn't translate well to a modern audience, and his jokes are terrible.
I love it when John Belushi says, "What did we give up when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor?"
Germans, forget it. He's rolling. So I think But the thing is, these writers who are like, I think Milton recently, it was his 400th birthday?
Yeah, it must have been. Wow, right? That guy is old. In the 16s.
Yeah.
What does
he
do that he probably never smokes?
Probably. How did Milton die? I forgot.
I don't know. I think he just died of old age.
Yeah, as a sad old blind man by himself.
Well, wasn't it?
As
so I know a little bit more than just Milton's old blind dude, which he is.
He was.
So that was factually accurate. But wasn't it like his daughter would like, he would like just say stuff and she would just like write it all down? Because he was like in and out of jail or something?
Yeah, he was in jail. Milton was a thug.
And he's like our modern construct of like heaven and hell, right? Like he created that essentially.
Yeah,
but, he was a jailbird.
Well, with heaven and hell, I think it's actually interesting. I think most people's conceptions of hell actually probably come either from Dante or from Milton.
Because the Bible really doesn't have all that much about hell.
No, I mean. Paradise Lost is fan fiction. It's straight up, it's straight up biblical fan fiction.
Wow, this guy was like, "Oh, I want the story to keep going. What happens next?"
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What do you think happened when you die?
It does take the Christian doctrine and makes it into a piece of Christian mythology. Yeah, in the greatest sense of the word. You know.
So just so 50 Shades of Grey, as you guys might know, is actually originally fan fiction of. Twilight.
Right.
Do you think, because back in the day, Milton was wildly popular, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that in like 400, 500 years, we will look back and say that 50 Shades of Grey is like some kind of almost religious text?
I think...
Isn't it already?
that's the right answer, I think.
And now, please turn to the Kama Sutra.
Wow. Yeah. And yeah, and like in 500 years, people are like, oh, yes, I know that the 50 Shades of Grey is very intractable and hard to, read, but it's very important that for literary reasons we read it, you know? And
actually,
no, that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah,
but.
Well, the funny thing is, it's actually really just from a literary, like just in literary history, it's fairly tame. 50 Shades of Grey. Yeah. I mean,
if you look at the Marquis de Sade. And stuff
I was
like
literally,
that,
I was about to say like 120 Days of Sodom. I mean, they've been doing this for a while.
I was just talking with a friend, like how crazy does it think, like how like you know, in certain portions of like during like the French Revolution, like just how liberal things got.
Yeah,
they were just like no holds barred. Like, and like I mean, because
Marquis de Sade killed a guy. Did he? I actually don't know.
He did some terrible things.
He was kind of a bastard.
I don't think you could publish 120 Days of Sodom nowadays. I think
whatever its place in literary history, I think that there's a place for 50 Shades of Grey in history at large, just because its appeal to like the older woman demographic.
Yeah,
and it's like it made everybody realize how kinky everyday people were. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like these taboo things, like. And the biggest problem that people had with 50 Shades of Grey is like, oh, this is domestic violence, this is sexual violence, but it was like. But people are really into it, even your mom and your grandma and your aunts.
Oh God!
Yeah, so that was the weird part about that, and I think that's just as a conversation piece. I think that's probably the most significant part about it. But that's where 50 Shades of Grey matters.
Yeah, it's culturally relevant in some ways.
Yeah, maybe that's what I'm trying to say. Thank you, Jack. Jake, thank you for summing what I have to say up. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like when you look back at famous reading, in years, I mean, you're really kind of like doing a work of anthropology almost, where you're looking at like what kind of defined that, you know, stage. And fortunately or unfortunately, a lot of people bought 50 Shades of Grey, probably unfortunately.
Something. No pun intended.
Hey-o. Where's the beans at?
There should be like a bad pun jar or something.
Oh, man. If there was, so the beans isn't here for this interview, but. If we had a bad pun jar, this podcast, we would be rich. Yassine would be, he would have no money. But the podcast would be fully funded. You know, it would be, he makes a lot of bad puns.
I feel like the strength of Yassine's puns is that how seriously he takes them, even when they're terrible.
He continues the joke. But that's like the secret to comedy, though, is like, you know, it's like return to the joke.
Yeah.
Shout out to the beans.
Hashtag beans. You can send hate mail to the beans at Words of the Podcast. We just had like our last guest was like, in the conversation with the last guest, we realized that we don't get any hate mail. And yeah. We feel like that's not,
not good.
If we were making a difference, then, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but this whole conversation about Fifty Shades of Grey, I can like maybe begin to reel it back to
Milton or
something.
Wait. We're about to connect 50 Shades of Grey to John Milton. This has never been done before in the history of literary criticism, and well, I think we should win the Nobel.
I think we should.
That'd be good for the podcast. Yeah. I mean, that'd be good for the Nobel Prize. I mean, if Words the Podcast was able to grace the Nobel Prize stage with our presence, I think that would really do a lot. I mean, I don't think that many people are familiar with it. And I think
Paradise Lost needs the Words the Podcast bump.
Yeah, listeners out there, it's an up and coming book, but I really think it's coming out hot. Check it out. No problem, John Milton. We got you. Yeah, he's a young guy with some pretty good ideas. He's going places. He doesn't know where he's going.
So,
wait, did you guys see the Justin Bieber roast?
Yes.
I think Kevin Hart like complimented Justin Bieber. He was like, he's got a voice like Kevin Hart. I mean, Kevin Hart said he's got a voice like Stevie Wonder, and he also drives like Stevie Wonder. But John Milton though.
Yeah. So Milton.
How is he being made accessible to you? You were talking about that.
Yeah. Well, I think we were talking about sort of like good professors and sort of like what separates like sort of like a bar, because something like Milton or Shakespeare could be like super boring, but it's not. I think that's just sort of like just the result of time. And I think sort of like the way I think of sort of like literary criticism or like sort of learning this stuff and why it's important is just because it's almost like film restoration. I think.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of, I mean, everything is sort of gonna, like, just the language is gonna get eroded over time, I think. And that's, I think, why sort of Shakespeare just and Milton are kind of like, you know, I mean, I personally kind of still wish we said thou. I think thou is really.
Really? I mean,
try that for a day. Just try.
Thou. I think people would be like, hey, shut up. Stop talking all fancy.
But
I mean, that is thou opinion. Thy opinion. That is thy opinion.
Yeah, that was one thing. Is it was always like kind of hard to tell. Like I guess like where thy thou thou. Like for example, like Satan's soliloquy in book four of Paradise Lost. It's like he could be talking to multiple people.
Yeah.
That was always my interpretation of it. It was he could be talking. Well,
set the scene here. So Satan.
Okay, so Satan.
right.
The Lord of Darkness. Milton would have been so into heavy metal.
Really would have been. Yeah. We should just quickly say. Okay, so some context. Drew and I are reading Paradise Lost for a class with Linda Gregerson, who we both think is fantastic. And you know what we've been saying, I think, is Linda makes the text accessible. I think that Linda's kind of just like a living piece of performance art. Like everything.
Absolutely.
She does,
I mean, she just brings us such energy, intellect,
intellect,
passion,
absolutely.
Beauty.
She's articulate and super intelligent. And when she talks about Milton, it makes you want to know more about it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Shout out to Linda.
And so,
big shout out.
So what we've been learning about in this class, a la Linda, thank God, is that Paradise Lost is really kind of counterintuitive. I mean, it's got an anti-hero, and maybe it's the first. I mean, I don't know the history of the anti-hero, but you would never expect to sympathize with Satan, and that's where we start. And so Drew actually.
So, but just to make sure I'm clear, so like when people are like, wow, like Mad Men is so groundbreaking, it's like no,
Milton was like, I invented this shit.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that we just take for granted that are Miltonic. You know, like saying that a cloud has a silver lining, that's from a poem he wrote. There's a bunch of examples like that. And the more I read Milton, the more I see them popping up everywhere.
Wow.
It's like...
It's crazy how like someone like just even 400 years ago can kind of like unknowingly shapes kind of how we view the world. And that so many structures of just thought that we have are kind of been in place because of this guy.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those, like you were talking about, one of those things that makes Shakespeare or Milton a lasting or a writer that remains important, even though he's not writing for us as his people, almost. Like, he's not a writer of his people, because his people are all gone. And we're not really speaking the same English, but...
Or are they?
Well, I mean...
sequel coming soon.
Paradise Lost 2. Paradise Paradise Reloaded.
Paradise Reloaded.
Yeah, it'll be like the Fast and the Furious series. But yeah, so anyway, so Drew did this great recitation, and we've been trying to have more dramatic readings on this podcast, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And Drew did like a 5 to 7 minute.
Was it that long?
Maybe it felt that long. I don't know.
No, it probably was. It was really tough, and I was really I was annoyed because I missed I think just one or two or four words here or there. And Milton is kind of like, he's one of those people like every word I guess counts.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like he probably would have. I don't know how he would have said.
I'm sorry, you had this memorized?
So yeah, I remember. Wow. But it was I loved it. It was a blast.
Wow, that's impressive.
Linda's having us do recitations for class for extra credit.
Mm-hmm.
And you did the soliloquy from book 4.
Yeah.
And I totally forgot.
No, I'm kidding. It was, I think it was just like grammar. but
could you do it right now?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I will just say one thing quickly. Drew was the only and the first person so far who like really got into it and like really acted it out and was Satan in the classroom for a little bit. So that was really cool. But yeah.
Maniacal laugh.
Well, yeah, maybe one quick question. How do you get in the mindset for Satan? As an actor.
Well, and Jack, it's funny you mentioned that. he's such an interesting character, just even still, and really I think memorizing it, at least this is the way I was doing it, was I really wanted to understand the words, but also understand sort of the motivation there, and sort of like we said, get into his head. But and maybe it was just, I think personally, because Milton's a great poet, but what makes him such an interesting character is he doesn't make you choose, like, say this is the good guy, this is the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has their reasons, everyone has sort of ideas, and Satan, what makes him so interesting, and you were mentioning Mad Men earlier. Well, it was really cool because you were looking at, thinking about his speech, and he believes, this is essentially like him kind of going through sort of his own sort of like, how did I get this far? How did I have become what I have been thrown to? And it really is kind of like, you realize this is someone who is in pain, who is an absolute, mm-hmm, just suffering. And even worse than that, he's trying to figure out why.
Yeah.
And it's kind of tragic because it's like, he really is like the first reject.
Wow, yeah.
He really is. And when I was saying about Mad Men,
that all on his own.
he was really, I think, I was actually kind of thinking of him like a cancer cell.
Fascinating.
Well, like a cancer cell doesn't have the choice to become a cancer cell, it just is a natural mutation.
Right.
In some ways, like an evolutionary trait that is what brought us here.
Exactly. And one of my favorite shows ever is Breaking Bad. So that's why you mentioned
anti-hero.
Well, I think what's amazing, and I think this is sort of, just sort of Milton kind of even in today. I mean, I don't know if it was like, intentional, but I mean, what's amazing about that show is, so many people hate Skyler White. Walter White's wife. For those of you who don't know, Breaking Bad was a television show, a fairly successful television show. She, like, everyone hated her, but she was doing the right thing. Mm. But we just understood Walter White so well that the only way that we kind of could have seen, like, oh wait, you're a terrible person.
Mm-hmm.
You're the devil. They even say, like, Mr. White, he's the devil. he really is like someone who thought he was doing the right thing by just ignoring sort of the idea of right or wrong.
Yeah.
Or in a way sort of like that And when I say, like, sort of why I was thinking, like, Satan as a cancer cell, Satan really was kind of... one thing Professor Gregerson always talks about is emulation opposites and sort of, like, you know, the duality of good and evil and how one is really just a dark reflection of the other. And this is really about the origin of evil.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize that, like a cancer cell, I think evil is something that thought that by doing its own will, it was doing good in a way.
So in a sense, there almost isn't that duality. There's just a twisting
right
of a single.
So by sort of just being Satan and opposing him, like by opposing God, he was essentially like doing what he thought was right.
Yeah.
Another thing that I was really kind of thinking about before is Milton, I wanted to make sort of like, at least with this recitation, I wanted to make him to a little more, well, really understandable, like, and charismatic why you would like him. And I read something really, really, that really disturbed me, but was also just one of those just like fascinating things you can't ignore, which is Adolf Hitler's favorite movie was Snow White.
Wow.
Yeah. And his favorite book was Don Quixote.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was like, this was a, like, this, yeah, like.
He was a person.
He had a sense of humor, I think. And that was really scary. Like he had a sense of innocence and a sense
He just kind of exists as, like, the end of some spectrum to us, but yet he's still on the spectrum.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I just remember, I went to Catholic school, and so, like, every year, like, you know, like, at some point in the year, like, we would go to, like, church and, like, get to, like, ask the priest questions or whatnot, and every single year, like, some kid would be like, is Hitler in hell? And the priest would be like, yes, Hitler is in hell. And we'd all be like, you don't know that, you know, like, and he was like, nope, he, you know, it was, like, this weird, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but he, yeah, he was a person.
Yeah, and,
We would also ask, is Gandhi in heaven? That was the other thing, too.
You know, to quote Neil Gaiman and rest in peace, the late, great Terry Pratchett, hell has all the best musicians, but heaven has the best choreographers. I guess it makes more sense.
They can never have the perfect party because they all have different parts of the same whole, I guess.
Yeah, and then I think they were also just using that as a way of saying, like, they were dancing in the car or something. But
there was another part. I like that we're bringing up Good Omens because that's another part of...
Just Milton's legacy. And
and this modern... the Christian aesthetic becomes more...
mythological.
Readable. Yeah, and just more... it just becomes more interesting, I think. And there's just a part of Good Omens where... It's not like the same humanizing Satan thing, but it is like the demon Crowley did not so much fall as
vaguely
as he did
sauntered downwards. It's more
Omens is
Omens is
fantastic book.
Fantastic book. I think we would probably categorize it as genre fiction, quote unquote. It's by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, and mm-hmm.
So they wrote that together.
Oh hell yeah!
They wrote that together.
That's interesting.
I thought you wanted to. Yeah, good. Sorry. I brought a book for just in case you wanted to double check it or whatever. But
I think what was so cool about Paradise Lost is it really was one of the first things that treated like, well, even if this is sort of a mythology, well, it still is afforded all the powers of a mythology, which are vast, and Good Omens was this. Phenomenal, hysterical book about the end of the world, or the end of days.
It's sort of like what Paradise Lost was to the creation story. Good Omens is to the Book of Revelations.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's like fictionalizing that story in a different way. And like, so Death is kind of a funny character. Death is like, he pops up in a lot of Terry Pratchett's work. And then he just kind of added like, Death was this like Carmen Sandiego kind of character,
I never realized that. That's exact. Yeah. That's so true.
Where in the world is War? She's everywhere.
Yeah.
I just want to say though, so you know Carmen Sandiego, you know, like I feel like how the whole point was to find her and whatnot. She had a terrible name for that. She's in San Diego.
No.
Her name is Carmen
Sandiego.
San Diegans.
In the spirit of this podcast, will you tell listeners what that means in German?
In German, I believe San Diego means a whale's vagina.
Thank you so much. All right.
But the actual translation has been lost to scholars. Scholars maintain.
But one interesting thing about the soliloquy, just on a conceptual level, I think, is Linda keeps telling us that Paradise Lost is not just a poem, it's a theodicy, which is to say it's a justification of the ways of God to man. So we talk about mythology, kind of, and it does have that mythic function, I think, to explain the unknown, the uncertain to, you know, us human beings, and trying to understand our tiny selves within that.
So, but to make sure I'm clear, so in a sense, you would kind of like read the Bible, and be like, whoa, I got a lot of questions. And then Milton would be like, well, I got some answers. Is that kind of...
That's exactly, I think.
Okay.
And you know, I think as far as like sort of like how much he answers them is often debated. I think you're never going to know everything. And I think that's sort of what he talks about. I love it just from an aesthetic perspective, just really as a piece of work, as a piece of fiction. I mean, it describes, I think, just the greatest battle in the history of the universe.
They were throwing hills.
I don't know what other teachers might have taught in Milton in the past, one Milton scholar, Nigel Smith, talks about like Milton used to like always be just right after Shakespeare, sort of like whenever like people brought him up, and you know, I think his faith might have like kind of led, and his republicanism might have like sort of like led it to his fall.
But you're saying he's kind of like the Michael Bay of theological texts?
I mean, yes.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. He describes, yeah, just this ultimate destruction. I mean, Satan invents cannons and everything.
Wow.
Yeah, no.
What a jerk.
Yeah.
For the purpose of pissing off God. This is why we have cannons, because Satan wanted to have some other form of, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting.
Take that, the NRA.
Also, it turns out...
you are literally doing Satan's will.
We just lost our NRA sponsorship. They were this close. They were like...
Anyway.
We just have to fire a raw off a Remington... Sorry, Philip. We just had to fire off a Remington shotgun every single episode.
So every time you do that, you're basically just doing the devil's work.
It's part of our sound profile. What can I say? Anyway, so just to bring this full circle, theodicy. This recitation that you did, the soliloquy of Satan's, I think that's interesting within a greater theodicy for its own. It's where I think the theodicy reaches its most urgent point. It's that the fever pitch of the theodicy. This is when like Satan is really trying to figure out like what is going on, like how, like what do I do?
Yeah, like why me? Really, I think it really is a fantastic kind of example of someone articulating sort of that thing that we all kind of have, that sometimes people are like, oh, well, he's just whining, but that like sort of someone like Hamlet or even like J.D. Salinger, I think, can kind of like really articulate, which is kind of like that angst. And I also love that I personally love that angst.
Do you think Satan comes off as self-absorbed in Paradise Lost?
He is self-absorbed.
Okay.
He is absolutely self-absorbed. But I think that's why people are drawn to him, is because he actually questions, like, well, why can I be self-absorbed?
Mm-hmm.
If you created us, and if you love all of us,
mm-hmm.
And if we are sort of like your love personified, then why can't we love ourselves? Why can't we sort of like live this selfish existence?
And how does Milton answer that? That's a fascinating question. Or does he? Does he leave it up to the...
He screws Satan.
Yeah, I mean, he screws Satan. The idea is basically just that you're never going to be as great as you think you're going to be.
Yeah?
There's always, I think, going to be one thing more. And I think that's sort of what it really is.
So is he trying to make the argument that like you, through self-absorption, if you're trying to find satisfaction in life, you're not going to be able to find it? Because when you are self-absorbed, Like they're just kind of like an inner longing for something better for yourself, and it's just more that you need to like make, you need to love the world more. You need to, I mean, is there, I mean, I obviously I'm kind of asking an unfair question, but
No, absolutely. You know, I mean, question.
Well, I want you to boil down like Milton to like a sentence. No, but like, you know,
boil down Milton to a sentence.
I mean, I'll throw one in there. I think it's like a case for Christian humility.
Hmm.
Because
yeah.
The
oh, absolutely, that's absolutely, yeah, that's perfect, yeah.
The original sin, I think you could say, is just
wanting
like too
more.
Much, yeah, just too, like a lack of humility, like why, like, he's like, why shouldn't I eat this fruit and no more? This seems fine. And the sin, what she sins against, I guess, ultimately, is just that faith in God, that willingness to be okay with what she's been given by God. So
mm-hmm.
That longing for something more, there's an entire chapter devoted to like man's fascination with the universe. Mm-hmm. And basically he's like kind of, you know, like shoulder off, like,
yeah,
there's no answer. Don't get too absorbed in that. So I guess that would be my answer to that.
So
that idea.
But for Milton though, he was a Protestant, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so he would have lived like, you know, I guess what, like 100, 200 years kind of after like the Reformation and whatnot. So, you know, I guess there was like a little bit more of, I mean, because obviously a big reason the Reformation happened, I guess, is because information kind of control and power in the church was so kind of like one-sided where, you know, it flowed through the priest down to the people in the pews. And so, you know, after the Reformation, I think that obviously this broke down a little bit and people got to question their own faith a little bit more. But obviously, I think at Milton's time, there probably was still.
I just realized this is like the best conversation for Good Friday.
Yeah, no, yeah, but yeah, it is. But for Milton's time, yeah, obviously, there's still like this very one-sided information and power and everything in general. That's just a time, you know, when that's how it was. So his audience then, because even the literate community was probably so tiny back then. Like, is he writing this? Like, is he like, I want priests and noblemen or politicians to read this, like who's he, or is he writing it for himself? Who do you think his audience is? Is he trying to convince? Because when you talk about like he's making the case for Christian humility, that sounds like he's writing towards maybe like leaders or whatnot and saying like, hey, like be more humble. I mean, like who is his target audience? I mean, is it college students 400 years in the future? That's who I write for. Whenever I write anything, I'm like college students 400 years from now. They're really going to dig this.
That's a fantastic question. I mean,
he did write in Latin for a while.
Yeah. He was the Latin secretary, right?
Yeah, I think so. His job in the government or the regime at the time was to, like, translate English into Latin for the rest of Europe and vice versa for England. I think that was his,
yeah.
His station.
And what you were saying about leadership, he is actually absolutely, I think, writing for leaders. He was a Republican. Back sort of like
when you say Republican, you mean like obviously not in our terms, and you mean like he wanted like a democratic government?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he was very he was for kind of like do you like and I think this is sort of an interesting question, is do you think he was for Oliver Cromwell?
Because
Oliver Cromwell, if this is sort of just my personal, like, conspiracy stupid theory.
Yeah?
Like, so, this has no scholastic value at all.
Okay.
Okay. Is, I always kind of thought maybe that it was kind of like, because Milton is incredibly subversive.
Yeah.
I always thought it was kind of like, almost like a hidden sort of, like, jab at sort of just the English Civil War.
Wow.
Which I actually think is like, I think there are like actual, like, you know, like people much smarter than me,
yeah,
who have, who I think have,
like probably like, yeah, maybe a book or two on,
yeah.
Well, was he, when he was thrown in jail, was he thrown in jail under Cromwell or under the royals, or do you know?
That I can't say.
And yeah, do you know what his,
I think we read about that in the commentary,
yeah.
But
was his jailing because of his writing? Or is it just because like he like got really drunk when I like pissed on the side of a building, and
oh, you hope it's that second one. I really you I wanted to like speeding down,
bro, Milton. Yeah, you can't ride your horses that fast through the thoroughfare. You're gonna hurt somebody. We're gonna throw you in jail for 90 days. Teach you some lessons. Were you riding that horse drunk? No, Yeah, recite the Latin alphabet backwards. But I guess that's just the regular alphabet now that I think about it. So
yeah, I think he was writing for everyone. I mean, something that Professor Gregerson always sort of says what his purpose. I mean, he says his purpose as well, like which is like he. I'd actually probably like put him closer, sort of like it, like sort of like a modern correlation. I'd actually probably put him like, and really, I think a lot of poets to rappers.
Okay, yeah, he's an MC of his time for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. And even like people like afterwards were like, "Yo, I don't like you, but I respect you."
Oh man, wow. That's an amazing way to look at Milton.
One way I think I might be able to answer your question, not to jump in.
Oh yeah, no.
But I think his initial reception, like that we've been hearing about it, was like among the clergy and among like the literary establishment, whatever there was of that. So whether or not he was widely read or read among like the common people, quote unquote, he was definitely well received, even right after publication, even like when he was alive to hear about the response to it. He was well received among those people, but I think inevitably Milton, his influence is definitely like in posterity. Like there's so much cultural capital built into this huge thing. It gets referenced all the time. A lot of times when we use a figure of speech or a turn of phrase, it's
Miltonian,
Miltonic in origin, or yeah, okay. Whatever.
That so needs to be a drink, the Miltonic.
I would gin love and Milton. Gin and Miltonic, yes.
But we just have to talk about literature.
I feel like there should be Fireball involved in that.
Oh my god! That's it. Yeah.
And you have to like light the drink on fire, and I don't think because Fireball doesn't have enough alcohol in it to.
Plus, Milton was a Fireball at the party.
Yeah,
that's a Willow Smith reference.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's all right. Do you want to do this recitation?
Yeah. Sorry. O thou, that with surpassing glory crowned, lookest from thy sole dominion like the god of this new world, at whose sight all the stars hide their diminished heads, to thee I call, but with no friendly voice, and add thy name, O sun, to tell thee how I hate thy beams that bring to my remembrance from what state I fell. How glorious once above thy sphere, till pride and worse ambition threw me down, warring in heaven against heaven's matchless king. Wherefore? He deserved no such return from me, whom he created what I was in that bright eminence, and with his good upbraided none. Nor was his service hard. What could be less than to afford him praise, the easiest recompense, and pay him thanks? How do? Yet all his good proved ill in me, and wrought but malice. Lifted up so high, I stained subjection, and thought one step higher would set me highest, and in a moment quit the debt immense of endless gratitude. So burdensome, still paying, still to owe. Forgetful what from him I still received, and understood not that a grateful mind by owing owes not, but still pays, at once indebted and discharged. What burden then? Oh, had his powerful destiny ordained me some inferior angel, I had stood then happy. No unbounded hope had raised ambition. Yet, why not? Huh? Some other power as great might have aspired, and me, though mean, drawn to his part. But other powers as great fell not, but stand unshaken from within, or from without, to all temptations armed. Hadst thou the same free will and power to stand? Thou hadst. Whom hast thou then, or what to accuse, but heaven's free love dealt equally to all? Be then his love accursed, since love or hate to me alike it deals eternal woe. Nay, cursed be thou, since against his thy will chose freely what it now so justly rues. Me miserable, which way shall I fly? Infinite wrath and infinite despair. Which way I fly is hell. Myself am hell, and in the lowest a lower deep, still threatening to devour me, opens wide, to which the hell I suffer seems a heaven.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the thing that strikes me the most about that is where it ends.
There's still more as well. I mean,
well, I mean, where your recitation ended, where he talks about how he can't escape hell because he's like, there's an internal hell, like he is of hell, like myself am hell, and how just the lowest deep that he knows is
just the beginning.
Yeah,
and that last part I think was. That really, I think, opened my eyes a lot to sort of Satan and sort of what Milton was talking about, which is that God isn't has done good things, but he is worse than Satan like what he can do. Like, mm-hmm. he can bring suffering that like even hell like dreads.
It's mm-hmm. literally unfathomable suffering because you can't fathom it.
Yeah,
it's abyssal, which is to say, an abyss comes from the Greek for no bottom. Something that's bottomless.
Thanks for listening. Remember to tune in next week.
Glyphs is Word's sophomore album where they really get back to their roots. An orchestral, satanic, doom metal, / chill, surfer, soft rock, easy listening, / ragtime, jazz, revival, hoedown, fusion. Topping the top 40 with singles like Baby, I Just Want to Melt Your Face Off, and Hell in an Actual Wicker Handbasket, they've really honed their style into something that nobody can listen to. Almost universally received as inimitable, yet pointlessly so, because why would you want to imitate them? The greater critical consensus is now coming around to the fact that Glyphs is Word's platinum achievement, in an avant-garde that is struggling to be misunderstood in a world that is already over its own unfathomability. We really do have to give Word's latest studio effort a solid 0 out of 10 as the highest form of praise we can give it.
Is he still going?
I think he was. Yeah, that was really long.
You thought that was.
I'm actually kind of impressed with that one.
You're impressed.
Yeah, Phil, that was nice work with that one.
With that.
Yeah. Are you not?
So we're trying to do a podcast. And...
Anyways, Words was produced in cooperation with the Amber District Library. It is hosted by The Beans, Phil Wittabean, and Jack Bologna. Jack Bologna is the show's creator. Brandon Reich is the director of the Amber Poetry Blast. Diane Thatch is our artist. And you are the listener. Now, the outtakes. You're sitting in the warm chair because that's where the heat comes out.
Yeah, I am. We should do a whisper episode.
No, that would be terrible.
Yeah, actually, I like a secret episode.
A secret episode?
Like, this is the secret episode of Words.
Welcome
to Words. I was stuck in Folsom Prison. Time keeps dragging on.
And
time keeps on rolling. Now, right around there.
When I was just a young man, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy.
Don't
you ever play with guns.
But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him
die.
Oh, sorry. No problem. Johnny Cash. Here we go. Johnny Cash fan?
Little.
Talk about Milton.